ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। हरे कृष्ण। टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भगवद् गीता चैप्टर 11 वर्सेस 19 थ्रू 31। अनादि मध्यंतम अनंत वीर्यम् अनंत बाहुं शशि सूर्य नेत्रम् पश्यामि त्वं दीप्त हुताशवक्त्रम् स्वतेजस विश्वमिदं तपन्तम्। Translation: You are without origin, middle or end. Your glory is unlimited. You have numberless arms, and the sun and moon are your eyes. I see you with blazing fire coming forth from your mouth, burning this entire universe by your own radiance. Although you are one, you spread throughout the sky and the planets and all space between. O great one, seeing this wondrous and terrible form, all the planetary systems are perturbed. All the hosts of demigods are surrendering before you and entering into you. Some of them, very much afraid, are offering prayers with folded hands. Hosts of great sages and perfected beings crying, "All peace," are praying to you by singing the Vedic hymns. All the various manifestations of Lord Shiva, the Adityas, the Vasus, the Sadyas, the Vishvadevs, the two Ashvis, the Maruts, the forefathers, the Gandharvas, the Yakshas, the Asuras, and the perfected demigods are beholding you in wonder. O all-pervading Vishnu, seeing you with your many radiant colors touching the sky, your gaping mouths, and your great glowing eyes, my mind is perturbed by fear. I can no longer maintain my steadiness or equilibrium of mind. All the sons of Dhritarashtra, along with their allied kings and Bhishma, Drona, and Karna, and our chief soldiers also, are rushing into your fearful mouths. And some I see trapped with their heads smashed between your teeth. As the many waves of the rivers flow into the ocean, so do all these great warriors enter blazing into your mouths. I see all people rushing full speed into your mouths as moths dash to destruction in a blazing fire. O Vishnu, I see you devouring all people from all sides with your flaming mouths, covering all the universe with your effulgence. You are manifest with terrible, scorching rays. O Lord of Lords, so fierce of form, please tell me who you are. I offer my obeisances unto you. Please be gracious unto me. You are the primal Lord. I want to know about you, for I do not know what your mission is. The purport to verse number 26 to 27 by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. In a previous verse, the Lord promised to show Arjuna things he would be very interested in seeing. Now, Arjuna sees that the leaders of the opposite party, Bhishma, Drona, Karna, and all the sons of Dhritarashtra and their soldiers, and Arjuna's own soldiers, are all being annihilated. This is an indication that after the death of nearly all the persons assembled at Kurukshetra, Arjuna will emerge victorious. It is also mentioned here that Bhishma, who is supposed to be unconquerable, will also be smashed. So also Karna. Not only will the great warriors of the other party like Bhishma be smashed, but some of the great warriors of Arjuna's side also. Om. Hare Krishna. I'm very grateful to all of you for coming tonight. I'm very delighted to be here. And also very embarrassed that there's many more qualified senior devotees who could be giving, but they've ceded their place to me, so I beg their blessings before continuing tonight. Tonight, we're of course reading from the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And as you may detect from the rushed pace with which we blew through these verses, the chapter 11 is generally misunderstood. And this gesture tonight is kind of an indication of devotees' general attitude towards the 11th chapter, in that it's so long-winded, so wordy, cumbersome, it's kind of dispensable. It's something we can just blaze through to get on to the next section. If you do a poll of devotees, I guarantee you ask them, what's your favorite chapter of Gita? They may say, oh, I like 15. But no one will ever say chapter 11, universal form. You ask devotees, what's your favorite prayers from the scriptures? Hardly anyone will say, oh, Arjuna's prayers to the universal form. So why this attitude? Why do we have this general mentality about the 11th chapter? And the reason Prabhupada gives himself in the purport of the 8th verse of his chapter, when he explains that, devotees who are correctly situated in a transcendental relationship with Krishna are attracted by loving features, not by a godless display of opulences. The playmates of Krishna, the friends of Krishna, and the parents of Krishna never want Krishna to show his opulences. So what we're observing in this chapter is actually very appropriate for the month of Damodar that we're in, because we're seeing the contrast between Krishna in his sweetest form as the little cowherd boy, Mother Yashoda's darling child, versus the blazing, fiery, death-like faces of the universal form. What is Mother Yashoda? Attraction to Krishna? Krishna has these tiny little hands, these tiny little feet, tiny little mouth, his tender little belly. She likes to embrace Krishna, take him on her lap, and breastfeed him. Milk flows just in profusion out of her love. It's said that Krishna, when he starts teething, his tiny little pearl-like teeth slowly come in, and it fills all the gopis of Vrindavan with so much joy to see Krishna growing up slowly like this. Instead, we have in this chapter the blazing death-like faces, awful, terrible teeth that are crushing Bhijma and Drona to a bloody pulp in the universal form's mouth. How could Yashoda ever relate to this form? It's kind of hard to breastfeed something with a million heads and a million arms. So the point is, the residents of Vrindavan, their love for Krishna is never overshadowed by Krishna's identity as God, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For example, when Krishna lifts Govardhan Hill, which is also happening in this month, he picks it up effortlessly on the tip of his pinky finger. It is a seemingly inhuman act, superhuman abilities. And yet, the residents of Vrindavan, they never react like Arjuna in fear or trepidation or trembling. What do they do? What do the cowherd men do when Krishna lifts Govardhan Hill on his finger? They say, oh no, our poor little Krishna is struggling under the weight. So they take up their sticks and they also help Krishna to hold up the hill. Mother Yashoda sees her darling son holding this heavy hill and she fears, oh, my Krishna is getting hungry. And she starts cooking. She's making him samosas and kachoris to eat. All the gopis are so enchanted because at last they get to interact full time for 7 days straight with Krishna right there in the hill. They're not awed or blown away by Krishna's abilities. They're totally enchanted, and they're still in love with Krishna as their friend or as their lover or as their little son. Similarly, one day when Krishna was out playing with his cowherd friends, they were playing a game, and it turns out that the cowherd boys lost to Krishna, and they came home running into Mother Yashoda's kitchen, and they said, oh, Maya, your little boy, he's been misbehaving. He's very naughty today. And Mother Yashoda said, what happened? And they said, Krishna has been eating dirt. We saw him out there. He's been eating mud. And so Yashoda says, Krishna, I make you so many nice sweets. How come you're eating mud? And Krishna denies the whole thing, of course. He says, oh, they're just jealous. They're speaking all these lies. They're conspiring against me. They're trying to incriminate me in this crime. I'm innocent. And then what does Balaram say? He says, He says, Krishna ne mati kaya, unka mume, mati ko deko. And so what does Mother Yashoda say? She says, fine, Krishna come here, let's see. And she opens up his mouth, and sure enough, what does she see? She sees the universal form of Krishna. She doesn't see the particular form shown on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, but she's blown away by a vision of mountains and rivers and lakes and the sun and the moon, the three modes of material nature, Lord Brahma, all the demigods are there, right in Krishna's mouth. And she sees something else very interesting. She sees herself breastfeeding Krishna inside of Krishna's little mouth like that. So how does Mother Yashoda react to all this? She just thinks she's dreaming. She doesn't think, oh, my son is God, and he's... She thinks that God is bewildering me. I'm subject to the illusory potency of the Supreme Personality. Somehow or other, my son may have some mystic powers. She even thinks that my poor little boy's digestion is disturbed. I should probably change his diet somehow. He's not liking the foods I'm giving him. And so Krishna, with his Lila Shakti, what does he do at this moment? He overwhelms Mother Yashoda's mind, and she becomes bathed in this Vatsalya Ras, this motherly affection. And she forgets all about this incident, and all she sees is her darling little child, and she just continues to breastfeed him. And life goes on, normally. So what's the significance of this? We see that even though the residents of Vrindavan are never bewildered by Krishna's godliness, Arjuna, on the other hand, is. Arjuna has a relationship with Krishna based on friendship. In the sense that he begins the Bhagavad Gita actually having Krishna as his chariot driver. And a chariot driver, a suta, is actually a shudra position. Within the social order, it's actually considered very fallen, very low. It's actually explained that in order to command the chariot driver which direction to go in, you tap him with your foot on his shoulder like that. So Arjuna, he's in this mood of ordering Krishna around. He tells him in the Gita, he says, Ratam stapaya mechuta, you put my chariot, senayoru bayormadye, in the middle of the battlefield. He's ordering, bossing Krishna around. And then, Bhishma Drona Pramukata, when he's in front of Bhishma and Drona, then Arjuna loses his composure. And at this point, his relationship with Krishna changes completely. He says, Yachtrayasya nishchitam bruhya tamme shishastiham shari mamtvam prapanam. He says, I am confused about my duty. Please instruct me. I am a disciple surrendered unto you. So all of a sudden, Arjuna went from some hotshot kshatriya, and now he's surrendered as a disciple of Krishna. Furthermore, we see that how is it that Arjuna is completely despondent on this battlefield? He can be right next to Krishna. He can reach his hand out and touch him personally, and still, he's totally depressed. His mind is reeling, he's trembling, he can't even hold on to his bow. So what does this indicate? Is that even if one is right in the immediate vicinity of Krishna, you can be in the temple, you can be praying to the Lord, you can have him in your home, you can be reading his books, but still, if the mood of submissiveness to Krishna is not there, then despite the fact of your proximity with Krishna, one's mind will still be completely disturbed. So Arjuna is demonstrating how the proper attitude that one should cultivate with Krishna is not this mood of domineering over Krishna, but to actually surrender to him and his disciples. So we've seen that the relationship has changed once. And then further, when the 11th chapter rolls around, rather than simply being a disciple of Krishna, learning, hearing instructions from him, all of a sudden, Krishna has been describing all his opulences, his vibhutis to Arjuna. And so he's overwhelmed with theoretical knowledge of Krishna as being God. And then all of a sudden, in the 11th chapter, we see that he's actually given him this direct vision, darshan, of his actual status as God, as the universal form. And so Krishna went from a friend, he went to a disciple, now he's astonished. He's completely blown away by this display. And then further in the chapter, that astonishment cedes place to what? Fear, to repulsion. That Arjuna becomes so practically disgusted by this form that he just begs Krishna, Drishtvedam Svajanam Krishna. He says, Tava Somyam Janardana. I don't want to see this universal form anymore. Please show me your Somya Vapu, your sweet two-handed form. So that's the point that we're bringing out in this chapter, is that it inspires so much fearfulness, so much horror to actually be exposed to Krishna as this fearful, blazing, scorching, burning hot entity out there. It actually really interferes with our devotional sentiments. on that very elevated platform, but simultaneously, it's also very valuable. The reason why the 11th chapter is given in Gita, in spite of this fearful nature, is that it's absolutely critical and essential for every single devotee to be acquainted with Krishna's actual, our relationship with Krishna and his actual status. So what is this? This is Sambandha Gyan. So this is what's coming out in the 11th chapter, is a proper understanding of Sambandha Gyan, which consists of three things, which is the living entity, Ishvara, God, and Prakriti, the material world. So these three things, unless these are actually there properly, then all the pure unalloyed devotion, the feelings of love in Vrindavan will never manifest until we actually acquire this knowledge that's being given in this chapter. But the reason the order of the chapters is given like this is we've seen that starting in the 7th chapter, Krishna is giving Arjuna so much information about his identity and how he pervades the universe. He's explaining that etad yonini bhutani sarva nityupadharya aham krishnasya jagata prabhava pralayastata. He says that all the spiritual, all the material worlds have me as their origin. I am the cause of all dissolution and creation. He's actually explaining that I am the beginning, the middle, and the end. Everything's coming from me. But at this point, it's very theoretical for Arjuna. He says, that sounds very interesting. You're an amazing friend to have. Please tell me more. And then furthermore, in 10th chapter, Krishna proceeds to explain how he has actually entered into creation. He's saying, of the bodies of water, I am the ocean. Of the beasts, I am the lion. Of the luminaries, I am the moon. He's explaining more information about himself in more detail. And so far it's been hearing about Krishna. So we all know that hearing is not necessarily the best means of acquiring knowledge. It's said that in any educational setting, something one hears, you only have something like a 20% chance of retaining. Something that you read, you have a much higher chance of retaining. But something that you see, you have a much greater chance. And then eventually, something that you actually teach or impart or have realized, that you have a very high potential of imbibing or assimilating. And so in this sense, we can say that chapters 7 through 10 is like hearing about Krishna on the radio. You've heard so many interesting stories or descriptions. But finally, chapter 11 is like television. Not just television with moving images, but like your 3D IMAX surround sound. It's actually a full presentation. And at this point, it just blows Arjuna away. So this is the point that's coming out, is the reason 11th chapter is given is to yield realization with Arjuna. Previously, his knowledge of Krishna was gyan. Now it's become vigyan. He's actually seen and experienced the terrible nature of this material world, and now he can actually act on this knowledge properly and fight. Secondly, the other reason why 11th chapter is given is for all future times to establish the unique position of Krishna as God and to discourage or to prevent cheating gurus from claiming to be God themselves. Because to show the universal form is a very unique ability. And there's a story in this connection I heard from one devotee in New York, and it actually concerns one of the greatest philosophers of our modern era being defeated by an ordinary street ISKCON devotee. So one day, there was a book distributor, and he was walking the streets of Manhattan, flagging down normal people, and he happened to be carrying Maha Big Books, Bhagavad Gita's that day, which he was distributing. And some background on this philosopher who he encountered that day is an eminent personality known as Jay Krishnamurti. Jay Krishnamurti is considered an authority not just on Bhagavad Gita, but on all worldly scriptures. He founded his own society. He later dissolved it. He had many thousands of followers all around the world. But he happened to be dressed in a very ordinary, unassuming way. And so when this book distributor saw just this ordinary, you know, gentleman walking down the street, Jay Krishnamurti, he was just coming from his meeting at the UN. And this book distributor stopped him and said, "Excuse me, sir, have you heard of Bhagavad Gita?" And our philosopher replies, "Bhagavad Gita? I spoke the Bhagavad Gita." And so this distributor is dumbfounded and says, "What? Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita. You're total nonsense." And so insulted, he said, "What? What are you talking about? I am Krishna." And the distributor said, "What are you talking about? Anybody who picks up this book and reads it once knows that you're not Krishna. You're just some ordinary schmo." And this man said, "What do you know of Gita? You know who I am?" And this distributor just said, "Well, fine, if you're Krishna, you show me your universal form right now." And so he was taken aback a little by the knowledge of the devotee. And he said, "Behold my mystic opulence." And the distributor looked around. He said, "Give me a break. Nothing happened. What are you talking about?" And so the distributor, and then Jay Krishnamurti said, "Ah, that's because you don't have the eyes to see my universal form." So the devotee took a step back and said, "Ha, Arjuna also didn't have the eyes to see the universal form. They were given to him by Krishna. So if you're really Krishna, you can give me the eyes to see your form too." And so he waited. It was still a bunch of skyscrapers, taxis driving by. And suffice to say, he didn't distribute a Bhagavad Gita to him on that day. Jay Krishnamurti did not become a bhakta at the local temple. But a principle was defended. It was maintained that no one can just claim to be Krishna, just stand up and pretend to be God. You have to back it up. You have to lift Govardhan Hill. You have to show the universal form in your mouth, or you have to manifest it somehow. You can't cheat your way to becoming God. And that's the primary reason why Arjuna actually implores Krishna to see this form. Because Arjuna himself, he's already convinced of Krishna's Godhead. He says, "Ritepi tvam pratiyeta." He says that, "Actually, I accept everything you say is truth, but just for fun, let's see your form." But Arjuna, eventually, he comes to regret this because it just completely ruins his relationship with Krishna. It spoils the whole kind of intimacy they had. Later on in the 11th chapter, Arjuna complains. He says, "Saketi matva prasabham yaduktam, he Krishna he Yadava he Saketi, ajanatam mahimanastavedam, maya pramadat pranayena vapi." He says, "Krishna, out of foolishness, out of madness, out of love, I refer to you as, O Krishna, O Yadava, O Sakka. Together, we lay on the same bed, we ate together, we jested, we relaxed, we played around, sometimes alone, sometimes in front of a group." He said, "Please forgive me for this travesty, for this gross violation of etiquette." So why is it that Arjuna is feeling so remorseful about this? What's so bad about calling him Krishna? Reason is, Acharyas explain, is that you don't just call Krishna Krishna. It's always Shri Krishna Bhagavan, Purna Purushottam Bhagavan. It's something with an honorific title. Similarly, hey Yadava, who is the Yadu dynasty? They're just minor kings, actually. So it's actually a put down for Arjuna to call Krishna Yadava, because he's part of the Pandavas, not only that, but the Kauravas. Who are they? They're the emperors of the entire world. And the Yadus are just a little small, minor royal dynasty. So it's kind of an insult. Similarly, oh friend, Arjuna is just saying, oh Sakka. It's just placing Krishna on the same level. Like, I have something to offer you, you know, I can help you out. Arjuna is not actually recognizing his proper position, and now he's feeling so much remorse in his heart for the way he treated Krishna. And so we find this is very interesting, because actually for Krishna, he doesn't like to show off his universal form. Krishna doesn't get a kick out of frightening all the demigods in the entire universe and panicking everyone and making them run in all directions. He's already God. He doesn't have anything to prove. Actually, Krishna prefers to be called Hey Krishna, Hey Yadava, Hey Sakka. He likes that. It makes him feel good to be chased by Mother Yashoda with a stick and have his belly bound up. He gets a rush out of it because the thing is, when you're God, everything's always going your way anyway. Our problem is that we're trying to be God. We're trying to control the world. We're trying to influence everything around us, but it's never working out. You know, the girl you like, oh, she doesn't even know who I am, or your cat gets run over, or someone dies in your family, and everything's always going wrong in this world. For Krishna, nothing ever goes wrong. He's Satya Sankalpa, which means that anything that he desires or wishes automatically becomes manifest by the strength of his being God. And so, when Mother Yashoda is chasing him with a stick, and he starts crying, and his curly locks are shaking, and his bell is ringing, and he's running all over the courtyard, he gets a kick out of it. He's like really crying. He's actually really feeling fear. But for him, it's the greatest ecstasy. Similarly, when Srimati Radharani chastises him, like in today's pastime, Radhakund appeared, and he killed Aristasura. And then Radharani and all her gopi friends, they're denying Krishna. They're saying, sorry, you can't dance with us. Krishna's not getting his way. He's not just walking in there, Mr. Smooth Operator. He actually has to atone for his sin. He's committed a great offense. But for Krishna, it's kind of fun. Because, you know, to bow his head at the feet of the gopis and to apologize and to beg for forgiveness, it's a refreshing change for someone like God. So, in this sense, we see that as far as how does it relate to us, is that this universal form is nothing we want to deal with. We don't really want to interact with it, because as Arjuna experienced, to see Bhishma and Drona and Karna rushing into Krishna's mouth, or sorry, it's actually Vishnu's mouth, and with this blazing like fire crushing their heads between their teeth, the fact is, the same thing's going to happen to us. We may laugh at Bhishma and Drona and Karna and Drona and Duryodhan for their plight, but it's not so funny because we're next. We're following after that into Krishna's teeth. As Kala Rupa, we're not really immune. We're not really safe from the destructive power of time. As Krishna says, Mrityu sarva harascham udbhavascha bhavishyatam. I am all-devouring death and the generating principle of all that will be. Krishna says, Kalosmi lokakshaya krit pravridho lokan samahartum iha pravritta. That time I am, the destroyer of worlds. And if we think that we're not going to be destroyed, everything we're attached to, everyone we'll love will all be destroyed, we're an illusion and we'll suffer. So the problem is that we're also in the same boat as all these warriors on the battlefield, in that we're also rushing headlong into Krishna's gaping mouth. So there's two ways to actually deal with this reality. And this is a very interesting point that's brought up by the Acharyas, is that later on in this chapter, Krishna is explaining two means or two analogies by which we also can rush into Krishna's fiery mouth. And what are those? Yata nadinam bahavam buvega samudram eva bhimukha dravanti. Nadinam means as rivers and the waves in the rivers flow into the ocean. Similarly, all these warriors on the battlefield are flowing into your mouth. And then secondly, it's explained, yata pradiptam jvalanam patanga vishaya nashaya samriddha vegaha. So the other option is a patanga, like a moth, goes jvalanam into the fire. It just rushes headlong, commits suicide into its own death. So this is the second analogy. First, the river into the ocean. Second, the moth into the flame. And the Acharyas explain that this represents, firstly, conscious suicide, conscious willing rushing into the jaws of death. And this is illustrated by Duryodhan. Duryodhan actually knew the power of the Pandavas. He actually knew Krishna's divinity. But Krishna, what did he do? He actually revealed his universal form to Duryodhan during their little peacekeeping or their, you know, negotiations. But in spite of this fact, Duryodhan, so stubborn, so egoistic, so conceited, still entered headlong into battle with God. And a funny point that comes up in the first chapter of Gita is that we learn of Krishna's introduction when he's actually blowing the conch shell. He explains that this conch shell's name, what's Krishna's conch shell's name? Panchajanya, thank you. He actually says that Panchajanyam Rishikesho Devadattam Dhananjaya. So Panchajanya is a very interesting little side note, is that when Sandipani Muni was instructing Krishna and Balaram in his ashram, this is in Krishna's childhood days, when Krishna was taking his Gurukul education, Krishna was such a brilliant student that Sandipani Muni wanted to beg a favor from Krishna, because it's the duty of the graduating student to offer a present to the teacher upon leaving the school. And so Sandipani Muni, of course, he had just lost his dear son in a very atypical way. His son was walking along the bank of the ocean, and he was eaten by a demon called Panchajanya, who was a conch shell demon, and his son disappeared. He was just gone, and Sandipani Muni was totally crushed, just in an instant, his son gone. So he implored Krishna to please. He said, "You're not an ordinary boy. You please save my son." So Krishna agreed, dove into the water. He ended up finding the demon. He smashed him. This is my speculation, but I think he was like a hermit crab of some kind. He actually killed the little crustacean inside, and then he snatched the conch shell, and he actually adopted that conch shell as his personal, you know, paraphernalia like that. So this, eventually, Krishna went to Yamaloka, and he took the same conch shell of Panchajanya, and upon blowing into it, this tumultuous sound overwhelmed Yamaloka. And who came running, offering obeisances at Krishna's feet? Who submitted himself right at Krishna's lotus feet? Yamaraj himself, the agent of death. Yamaraj is the one who dispatches people to their next destination, their next body. He's the one who decides who lives, who dies. And so Krishna, in this first chapter, Panchajanyam Rishikesho, he's actually demonstrating by blowing into this conch shell that, sorry, Kauravas, you guys don't have a single chance. What can you do when Yamaraj is on the side of the army? It's actually impossible, because just by his glance, just by snapping his finger, immediately, all the Kauravas can be immediately destroyed because Yamaraj is on their side. So the odds are heavily stacked against Duryodhan. In spite of all this knowledge, Duryodhan refuses to submit, continues to wage war against the Pandavas, and like a moth into fire, willingly annihilates himself. And so in the same way, we see that in the material world, many of us are in Duryodhan's position, is that we've heard knowledge of Gita. We know we're going to die. We know everyone around us is going to die. Everything's temporary. This place is miserable. But in spite of this fact that the odds are stacked against us, that the possibility of us enjoying in this world are slim to none, still we go on trying to oppose Krishna's instruction, oppose Krishna's devotees, and go on with our silly, mad ambitions. So in contrast to this, we have the other example of the river entering into the ocean. And this is someone who is just carried along automatically by the force of time. And this is indicated by our Dronacharya and Bhishma Dev. As we know, Bhishma Dev was fighting against Krishna, fighting against the Pandavas, but it was simply by the force of circumstance. Due to his staunch vow and his loyalty and his great valor and character, he agreed to fight for the Kauravas. But it's revealed later on in Bhagavatam that even though he was firing arrows at Krishna, trying to kill Arjuna, and even though there was so much rivalry, Krishna at one point took the chariot wheel and he tried to slice Bhishma Dev's head off. We find out later, when Bhishma's pierced by all these arrows, he looks like a pincushion, he's in his last dying moments, Bhishma Dev's actual love for Krishna comes out. His inner devotion reveals itself. And his inner meditation is actually the first instance of Madhurya Ras, or the gopis' pastimes with Krishna in the Bhagavatam, that emerges in Bhishma Dev's prayers and actually his speech. So Bhishma Dev is actually a very exalted devotee, even though it may seem like he's opposed to Krishna. So in the same way, one in this world should develop that Bhishma Dev-like mentality that even in spite of the fact, yeah, I'm not living in the temple, yeah, I'm not chanting 64 rounds, yeah, I'm kind of a lazy devotee, in spite of the fact that we have so many distractions besides pure and alloyed devotional service, still within the core of our hearts, we're actually pursuing this course of this river into Krishna's loving embrace, finally. And that we're performing our duties in this world. We're actually very attentively engaging with the sense objects. We're actually having our nice family, our nice business, our car, our closet, our furniture, you know, our locker, whatever. All these things, they're different material trappings, but they all belong to the universal form of the Lord. That nothing actually is separate from the Lord. And the more we can cultivate this consciousness that Krishna is all-pervading, that we can't get away from him, we have to actually connect everything we have in this world to Krishna, and in that way, we can actually glide happily, peacefully into, again, Krishna's embrace, into his loving pastimes. And so in this sense, to conclude, we see that Arjuna, he didn't have to see the universal form of the Lord. He could have just opted not to. And in the same way, we, all of us, can avoid dealing with this material energy if we so chose. You know, no one's telling us to struggle out there in the world and have all these attachments and to work, but what can we do? We have to work in spite of that. And just like Arjuna performed his duty to serve the Lord, similarly, we should also continue very sincerely to serve the Lord and avoid his burning death-like mouth. So thank you very much for your kind attention today. Would anybody like to ask any questions? I thought I saw... No. Jai Shri Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai.